us. He was holding on to the gun and nightstick on his belt, which made him look like he was running with his hands on his hips. He was shouting about regulations and how idiots had been killed climbing into cages and how we all had to leave immediately. He grabbed Dad by the shoulder, but Dad pushed him off and assumed a fighting stance. Some of the men in the crowd clutched Dad's arms, and Mom asked Dad to please do what the guard had ordered. Dad nodded and held out his hands in a peace gesture. He led us through the crowd and toward the exit, chuckling and shaking his head to let us kids know that these fools were not worth the time it would take to kick their butts. I could hear people around us whispering about the crazy drunk man and his dirty little urchin children, but who cared what they thought? None of them had ever had their hand licked by a cheetah. It was around this time that Dad lost his job. He said there was nothing to worry about because Phoenix was so big and growing so fast that he could find another job at a site where they hadn't spread lies about him. Then he got fired from his second job and from his third and was kicked out of the electricians' union and started doing odd jobs and day work. Whatever money Mom had inherited from Grandma Smith had disappeared, and once again we were scraping by. I didn't go hungry. Hot school at lunch cost a quarter, and we could usually afford that. When we couldn't, and I told Mrs. Ellis, my fourth grade teacher, that I had forgotten my quarter, she said her records indicated that someone had already paid for me. Even though that seemed awfully coincidental, I didn't want to push my luck by asking too many questions about who this someone was. I ate the hot lunch. Sometimes that lunch was all I had to eat all day, but I could get by just fine on one meal. One afternoon when Brian and I had come home to an empty fridge, we went out to the alley behind the house looking for bottles to redeem. Down the alley was a delivery bay of a warehouse. A big green dumpster stood in the parking lot. When no one was looking, Brian and I pushed open the lid, climbed up, and dived inside to search for bottles. I was afraid it might be full of yucky garbage. Instead, we found an astonishing treasure. Cardboard boxes filled with loose chocolates. Some of them were whitish and dried out looking, and some were covered with a mysterious green mold, but most of them were fine. We pigged out on chocolates, and from then on, whenever Mom was too busy to make dinner or we were out of food, we'd go back to the dumpster to see if any new chocolate was waiting for us. From time to time, it was. For some reason, there were no kids Maureen's age on North 3rd Street. She was too young to run around with me and Brian, so she spent most of her time riding up and down on the red tricycle Dad had bought for her and playing with her imaginary friends. They all had names, and she would talk to them for hours. They'd laugh together, carry on detailed conversations, even argue. One day she came home in tears, and when I asked her why she was crying, she said she'd gotten into a fight with Susie Q, one of the imaginary friends. Maureen was 5 years younger than Brian, and Mom said since she didn't have any allies in the family around her age, she needed special treatment. Mom decided Maureen needed to enroll in preschool, but she said she didn't want her youngest daughter dressed in the thrift store clothes the rest of us wore. Mom told us we'd have to go shoplifting. "Isn't that a sin?" I asked Mom. "Not exactly," Mom said. "God doesn't mind you bending the rules a little if you have a good reason. It's sort of like justifiable homicide. This is justifiable pilfering." Mom's plan was for her and Maureen to go into the dressing room of a store with an armful of new clothes for Maureen to try on. When they came out, Mom would tell the clerk she didn't like any of the dresses. At that point, Lori, Brian, and I would create a ruckus to distract the clerk while Mom hid a dress under a raincoat she would be carrying on her arm. We got 3 or 4 nice dresses for Maureen that way. But on one excursion, when Brian and I were pretending to punch each other out and Mom was in the process of slipping a dress under her raincoat, the sales lady turned to Mom and asked if she intended to buy that dress she was holding. Mom had no choice but to pay for it. $14 for a child's dress, she said as we left the store. It's highway robbery. Dad devised an ingenious way to come up with extra cash. He figured out that when you made a withdrawal from the drive-thru window at the bank, it took a few minutes for the transaction to register in the computer. So he would open a bank account, and a week or so later, he would withdraw all the money from the teller inside the bank while Mom withdrew the same amount from the drive-thru window. Lori said it sounded outright felonious, but Dad said all he was doing was outsmarting the fat cat bank owners who Shylock the common man by charging usurious interest rates. "We're innocent expressions," Mom told us kids the first time we dropped Dad off in front of the bank. "Will we have to go to a juvenile delinquent center if we get busted?" I asked. Mom assured me it was all perfectly legal. "People overdraw their accounts all the time," she said. "If we get caught, we'll just pay a little overdraft fee." She explained that it was sort of like taking out a loan without all the messy paperwork. But as we drove up to the teller's window, Mom seemed to get edgy and giggled nervously as she passed the withdrawal slip through the bulletproof window. I think she was enjoying the thrill of taking from the rich. After the woman inside passed us the cash, Mom drove around to the front of the bank. In a minute, Dad strolled out. He climbed into the front of the car, turned around, and with a wicked grin, held up a stack of bills and rifled them with his thumb. The reason Dad was having a tough time getting steady work, as he kept trying to tell us, was that the electricians' union in Phoenix was corrupt. It was run by the mob, he said, which controlled all the construction projects in the city. So before he could get a decent job, he had to run organized crime out of town. That required a lot of undercover research, and the best place to gather information was at the bars the mobsters owned. So Dad started spending most of his time in those joints. Mom rolled her eyes whenever Dad mentioned his research. I began to have my own doubts about what he was up to. He came home in such a drunken fury that Mom usually hid while we kids tried to calm him down. He broke windows and smashed dishes and furniture until he'd spent all his anger. Then he'd look around at the mess and at us kids standing there. When he recognized what he'd done, he hung his head in weariness and shame. Then he'd sink to his knees and pitch forward face first on the floor. After Dad had collapsed, I would try to pick up the place, but Mom always made me stop. She'd been reading books on how to cope with an alcoholic, and they said that drunks didn't remember their rampages. So if you cleaned up after them, they'd think nothing had happened. Your father needs to see the mess he's making of our lives, Mom said. But when Dad got up, he'd act as if all the wreckage didn't exist, and no one would discuss it with him. The rest of us had to get used to stepping over broken furniture and shattered glass. Mom had taught us to pick Dad's pocket when he passed out. We got pretty good at it. Once, after I'd rolled Dad and collected a handful of change, I pried his fingers loose from the bottle in his hand. It was 3/4 empty. I stared at the amber liquid. Mom never touched the stuff, and I wondered what Dad found so irresistible. I opened the bottle and sniffed. The awful smell stung my nose, but after I worked up my courage, I took a swig. It had a hideously thick taste, smoky and so hot it burned my tongue. I ran to the bathroom, spat it out, and rinsed my mouth. "I just took a swig of booze," I told Brian. "It's the worst thing I've ever tasted in my life." Brian grabbed the bottle out of my hand. He emptied it into the kitchen sink, then led me out to the shed and opened up a wooden trunk in the back marked toy box. It was filled with empty liquor bottles. "Whenever Dad passed out," Brian said, "he took the bottle Dad had been drinking, emptied it, and hid it in the trunk. He'd wait until he had 10 or 12, then tote them to a garbage can a few blocks away, because if Dad saw the empty bottles, he would get furious. I have a really good feeling about this Christmas, Mom announced in early December. Lori pointed out that the last few months hadn't gone so well. Exactly, Mom said. This is God's way of telling us to take charge of our own fates. God helps those who help themselves. She had such a good feeling that she decided that this year we were going to celebrate Christmas on Christmas Day instead of a week later. Mom was an expert thrift store shopper. She read the labels on the clothes and turned over dishes and vases to study the markings on the bottom. She had no qualms about telling a saleslady that a dress marked at 25 cents was worth only a dime, and usually she got it at that price. Mom took us thrift store shopping for weeks before that Christmas, giving us each a dollar to spend on presents. I got a red glass bud vase for Mom, an onyx ashtray for Dad, a model car kit for Brian, a book about elves for Lori, and a stuffed tiger with a loose ear that Mom helped me sew back in place for Maureen. On Christmas morning, Mom took us to a gas station that sold Christmas trees. She selected a tall, dark, but slightly dried-out Douglas fir. "This poor old tree isn't going to sell by the end of the day, and it needs someone to love it," she told the man and offered him $3. The man looked at the tree and looked at Mom and looked at us kids. My dress had buttons missing. Holes were appearing along the seams of Maureen's T-shirt. "Lady, this one's been marked down to a buck," he said. We carried the tree home and decorated it with Grandma's antique ornaments, ornate colored balls, fragile glass partridges, and lights with long tubes of bubbling water. I couldn't wait to open my presents, but Mom insisted that we celebrate Christmas in the Catholic fashion, getting to the gifts only after we'd attended midnight mass. Dad, knowing that all the bars and liquor stores would be closed on Christmas, had stocked up in advance. He popped open the first Budweiser before breakfast, and by the time midnight mass rolled around, he was having trouble standing up. I suggested that maybe this once, Mom should let Dad off the hook about going to mass, but she said stopping by God's house for a quick hello was especially important at times like this. So Dad staggered and lurched into the church with us. During the sermon, the priest discussed the miracle of Immaculate Conception and the virgin birth. "Virgin my ass," Dad shouted. "Mary was a sweet Jewish broad who got herself knocked up." The service came to a dead halt. Everyone was staring. The choir had swiveled around in unison and were gaping open-mouthed. Even the priest was speechless. Dad had a satisfied grin on his face. "And Jesus H. Christ is the world's best-loved bastard." The ushers grimly escorted us to the street. On the way home, Dad put his arm around my shoulder for support. "Baby girl, if your boyfriend ever gets into your panties and you find yourself in a family way, swear that it was Immaculate Conception and start mouthing off about miracles," he said. "Then just pass around the collection plate come Sunday." I didn't like Dad when he talked like that, and I tried to move away from him, but he just held me tighter. Back at home, we tried to calm Dad down. Mom gave him one of his presents, a brass cigarette lighter from the 1920s in the shape of a Scottish terrier. Dad flicked it a couple of times, swaying back and forth. Then he held it up to the light and studied it. "Let's really light up this Christmas," Dad said, and thrust the lighter into the Douglas fir. The dried-out needles caught fire immediately. Flames leapt through the branches with a crackling noise. Christmas ornaments exploded from the heat. For a few moments, we were too stunned to do anything. Mom called for blankets and water. We were able to put the fire out, but only by knocking down the tree, smashing most of the ornaments, and ruining all our presents. Dad sat on the sofa the whole time, laughing and telling Mom that he was doing her a favor because trees were pagan symbols of worship. Once the fire was out and the sodden, burned tree lay smoldering on the floor, we all just stood there. No one tried to wring Dad's neck or yell at him or even point out that he'd ruined the Christmas his family had spent weeks planning, the Christmas that was supposed to be the best we'd ever had. When Dad went crazy, we all had our own ways of shutting down and closing off. And that was what we did that night. I turned 10 that spring, but birthdays were not a big deal around our house. Sometimes Mom stuck a few candles and some ice cream and we all sang Happy Birthday. Mom and Dad might get us a little present, a comic book or a pair of shoes or a package of underwear, but at least as often, they forgot our birthdays altogether. So I was surprised when, on the day I turned 10, Dad took me outside to the back patio and asked me what I wanted most in the world. "It's a special occasion, seeing as how it puts you into double digits," he said. "You're growing up damn fast, Mountain Goat. You'll be on your own in no time. And if there's anything I can do for you now, before you're gone, I want to do it." I knew Dad wasn't talking about buying me some extravagant present like a pony or a dollhouse. He was asking what he could do, now that I was almost grown up, to make my last years as a kid everything I hoped they'd be. There was only one thing I truly wanted. Something that I knew would change all our lives. But I was afraid to ask for it. Just thinking about saying the words out loud made me nervous. Dad saw my hesitation. He knelt so that he was looking up at me. "What is it?" he said. "Ask away. It's big. Just ask, baby. I'm scared. You know, if it's humanly possible, I'll get it for you. And if it ain't humanly possible, I'll die trying." I looked at the thin swirls of clouds high in the blue Arizona sky. Keeping my eyes fastened on those distant clouds, I took a breath and said, "Do you think you could maybe stop drinking?" Dad said nothing. He was staring down at the cement patio, and when he turned to me, his eyes had a wounded look, like a dog who's been kicked. "You must be awfully ashamed of your old man," he said. "No," I said quickly. "It's just I think Mom would be a lot happier. Plus we'd have the extra money." "You don't have to explain," Dad said. His voice was barely a whisper. He stood up and walked into the yard and sat down under the orange trees. I followed and sat down next to him. I was going to take his hand, but before I could reach for it, he said, "If you don't mind, honey, I think I'd like to sit here by myself for a while." In the morning, Dad told me that for the next few days, he was going to keep to himself in his bedroom. He wanted us kids to steer clear of him, to stay outside and play. Everything went fine for the first day. On the second day, when I came home from school, I heard a terrible groaning coming from the bedroom. "Dad?" I called. There was no answer. I opened the door. Dad was tied to the bed with ropes and belts. I don't know if he had done it himself or if Mom helped him, but he was thrashing about, bucking and pulling at the restraints, yelling, "No!" and "Stop!" and "Oh my God!" His face was gray and dripping with sweat. I called out to him again, but he didn't see or hear me. I went into the kitchen and filled an empty orange juice jug with water. I sat with a jug next to Dad's door in case he got thirsty. Mom saw me and told me to go outside and play. I told her I wanted to help Dad. She said there was nothing I could do, but I stayed by the door anyway. Dad's delirium continued for days. When I came home from school, I'd get the jug of water, take up my position by the door, and wait there until bedtime. Brian and Maureen played outside, and Lori kept to the far side of the house. Mom painted in her studio. No one talked much about what was going on. One night, when we were eating dinner, Dad let out a particularly hideous cry. I looked at Mom, who was stirring her soup as if it were an ordinary evening. And that was when I lost it. "Do something," I yelled at her. "You've got to do something to help Dad." "Your father's the only one who can help himself," Mom said. "Only he knows how to fight his own demons." After the better part of a week, Dad's delirium stopped. And he asked us to come talk to him in the bedroom. He was propped up on a pillow, paler and thinner than I'd ever seen him. He took the water jug I offered him. His hands were shaking so badly that he had trouble holding it, and the water dribbled down his chin as he drank. A few days later, Dad was able to walk around, but he had no appetite, and his hands still trembled. I told Mom that maybe I had made a terrible mistake, but Mom said sometimes you have to get sicker before you can get better. Within a few more days, Dad seemed almost normal, except he'd become tentative, even kind of shy. He smiled at his kids a lot and squeezed our shoulders, sometimes leaning on us to steady himself. "I wonder what life will be like now," I said to Lori.
"The same," she said. "He tried stopping before, but it never lasted."
"This time it will."
"How do you know?"
"It's his present to me." Dad spent the summer recuperating. For days on end, he'd sit under the orange trees reading. By early fall, he had recovered most of his strength. To celebrate his new life on the wagon, and to put some distance between himself and his drinking haunts, he decided that the Walls clan should take a long camping trip to the Grand Canyon. Would avoid the park rangers and find a cave somewhere along the river. Would swim and fish and cook our catch over an open fire. Mom and Lori could paint, and Dad and Brian and I could climb the cliffs and study the canyon's geological strata. It would be like old times. We kids didn't need to be going to school, he said. He and Mom could instruct us better than any of those shit-for-brains teachers. "You, Mountain Goat, can put together a rock collection, the likes of which has never been seen," Dad told me. Everyone loved the idea. Brian and I were so excited, we did a jig right there on the living room floor. We packed blankets, food, canteens, fishing line, the lavender blanket Maureen took everywhere, Lori's paper and pencils, Mom's easel and canvases and brushes and paints. What we couldn't fit in the trunk of the car, we tied to the top. We also took along Mom's fancy archery set, the one made of inlaid fruit wood, because Dad said you never know what wild game we might find in those canyon recesses. He promised Brian and me that we'd be shooting that bow and arrow like a couple of full-blooded Indian kids by the time we came back. If we ever came back. Hell, we might decide to live in the Grand Canyon permanently. We started out early the next morning. Once we got north of Phoenix, past all the tract house suburbs, the traffic thinned, and Dad started going faster and faster. "There ain't no better feeling than being on the move," he said. We were out in the desert by now, the telephone poles snapping past. "Hey, Mountain Goat," he hollered. "How fast do you think I can make this car go?" "Faster than the speed of light," I said. I leaned over the front seat and watched the needle on the speedometer creep up. We were doing 90 miles an hour. "You're going to see that little needle go all the way off the dial," Dad said. I could see his leg move as he stepped on the gas. We'd roll down the windows, and maps and art paper and cigarette ashes were whipping around our heads. The speedometer needle crept past 100, the last number on the dial, and pushed into the empty space beyond. The car started shuddering, but Dad didn't let up on the accelerator. Mom covered her head with her arms and told Dad to slow down, but that only made him press on the gas even harder. Suddenly there was a clattering noise under the car. I looked back to make sure no important part had fallen off, and saw a cone of gray smoke billowing behind us.
Just then, white steam that smelled like iron started pouring out from the sides of the hood and blowing past the windows. The shuddering increased, and with a terrible coughing, clunking noise, the car began to slow. Soon it was going at no more than a crawl. Then the engine died altogether. We coasted for a few yards in silence before the car stopped. "Now you've done it," Mom said. We kids and Dad got out and pushed the car to the side of the road while Mom steered. Dad lifted the hood. I watched while he and Brian studied the smoking, grease-encrusted engine and discussed the parts by name. Then I went to sit in the car with Mom, Lori, and Maureen. Lori gave me a disgusted look, as if she thought it was my fault that the car had broken down. "Why do you always encourage him?" she asked. "Don't worry," I said. "Dad will fix it." We sat there for a long time. I could see buzzards circling high in the distance, which reminded me of that ingrate Buster. Maybe I should have cut him some slack. With his broken wing and a lifetime of eating roadkill, he probably had a lot to be ungrateful about. Too much hard luck can create a permanent meanness of spirit in any creature. Finally, Dad shut the hood. "You can fix it, can't you?" I asked. "Of course," he said, "if I had the proper tools." We'd have to temporarily postpone our expedition to the Grand Canyon, he told us. Our first priority now was to head back to Phoenix so he could get his hands on the right tools. "How?" Lori asked. "Hitchhiking was one option," Dad said, "but it might be hard finding a car with enough room to accommodate four kids and two adults. Since we were also athletic, and since none of us were whiners, walking home would be no problem." "It's almost 80 miles," Lori said. "That's right," Dad said. "If we covered 3 miles an hour for 8 hours a day, we could make it in 3 days." We had to leave everything behind except Maureen's lavender blanket and the canteens. That included Mom's Fruitwood archery set. Since Mom was attached to that archery set, which her father had given her, Dad had Brian and me hide it in an irrigation ditch. We could come back to retrieve it later. Dad carried Maureen. To keep our spirits up, he called out, "Hup, 2, 3, 4. But Mom and Lori refused to march along in step. Eventually, Dad gave up, and it was quiet except for the sound of our feet crunching on the sand and the rocks and wind whipping off the desert. After walking for what seemed like a couple of hours, we reached a motel billboard that we had passed only a minute or so before the car broke down. The occasional car whizzed by, and Dad stuck out his thumb, but none of them stopped. Around midday, a big blue Buick with gleaming chrome bumpers slowed down and pulled onto the shoulder in front of us. A lady with a beauty parlor hairdo rolled down the window. "You poor people," she exclaimed. "Are you okay?" She asked us where we were going, and when we told her Phoenix, she offered us a ride. The air conditioning in that Buick was so cold that goosebumps popped up on my arms and legs. The lady had Lori and me pass around Coca-Colas and sandwiches from a cooler in the footwell. Dad said he wasn't hungry. The lady kept talking about how her daughter had been driving down the highway and had seen us, and when she got to the lady's house, had told her about this poor family walking alongside the road. And I said to my daughter, "Why, I can't leave those poor people out there." I told my daughter, "Those poor kids must be dying of thirst." "Poor things." "We're not poor," I said. She had used that word one too many times. "Of course you're not," the lady quickly replied. "I didn't mean it that way." But I could tell that she had. The lady grew quiet, and for the rest of the trip, no one said much. As soon as she dropped us off, Dad disappeared. I waited on the front steps until bedtime, but he didn't come home. 3 days later, while Lori and I were sitting at Grandma's old upright piano trying to teach each other to play,
We heard heavy, uneven footsteps at the front door. We turned and saw Dad. He tripped on the coffee table. When we tried to help him, he cursed and lurched at us, swinging his fist. He wanted to know where that goddamn sorry-ass mother of ours was. And he got so mad when we didn't tell him that he pulled over Grandma's china closet, sending her fine bone china crashing to the floor. Brian came running in. He tried to grab Dad's leg, but Dad kicked him off. Dad yanked out the silverware drawer and hurled the forks and spoons and knives across the room, then picked up one of the chairs and smashed it on Grandma's table. "Rosemary, where the goddamn hell are you, you stinking bitch?" he yelled. "Where is that whore hiding?" He found Mom in the bathroom, crouched in the tub. As she darted past him, he grabbed her dress and she started flailing. They fought their way into the dining room, and he knocked her to the floor. She reached into the pile of kitchen utensils that Dad had thrown there, grabbed a butcher knife, and slashed it through the air in front of him. Dad leaned back. "A knife fight, eh?" he grinned. "Okay, if that's what you want." He picked up a knife too, tossing it from hand to hand. Then he knocked the knife out of Mom's hand, dropped his own knife, and wrestled her to the floor. We kids pounded on Dad's back and begged him to stop, but he ignored us. At last, he pinned Mom's hands behind her head. "Rosemary, you're one hell of a woman," Dad said. Mom told him he was a stinking, rotten drunk. "Yeah, but you love this old drunk, don't you?" Dad said. Mom at first said no. She didn't. But Dad kept asking her again and again. And when she finally said yes, the fight disappeared from both of them. Vanished as if it had never existed. Dad started laughing and hugging Mom, who was laughing and hugging him. It was as if they were so happy they hadn't killed each other that they had fallen in love all over again. I didn't feel like celebrating. After all he'd put himself through, I couldn't believe Dad had gone back to the booze. With Dad drinking again and no money coming in, Mom began to talk about moving east, to West Virginia, where Dad's parents lived. Maybe his parents would help keep him in line. If nothing else, they could help us out financially, like Grandma Smith had done from time to time. "We'd love it in West Virginia," she told us. "We'd live in the forest in the mountains with the squirrels and the chipmunks. We could meet our grandma and grandpa Walls, who were genuine hillbillies." Mom made living in West Virginia sound like another great adventure, and pretty soon all us kids had signed on for the trip. Dad hated the idea, however, and refused to help Mom, so she plodded on her own. Since we had never retrieved the car or any of our stuff from the failed Grand Canyon expedition, the first thing Mom needed was a set of wheels. She said that God works in mysterious ways, and it just so happened that she had inherited some land in Texas when Grandma died. She waited until she received a check for several $100s from the company that was leasing the drilling rights. Then she went to buy a used car. A local radio station had a promotional broadcast once a week from a car lot that we passed on our way to school. Every Wednesday, the DJs and used car salesmen would rave on air about the incredible deals and the lowest prices around. To prove their point, they'd announce the Piggy Bank Special, some car priced under $1,000 that they'd sell to the first lucky caller. Mom set her sights on a Piggy Bank Special. She wasn't taking any chances on being the first caller. She went down with her cash and sat in the dealership office while we kids waited on a park bench across the street, listening to the broadcast on a transistor radio. The Piggy Bank Special that Wednesday was a 1956 Oldsmobile, which Mom bought for $200. We listened as she took to the airwaves to tell the radio audience she knew a heck of a bargain when she saw one. Mom was not allowed to test drive the Piggy Bank Special before buying it. The car lurched and stalled several times on the way home. It was impossible to tell whether it was Mom's driving or whether we had bought a lemon. We kids were not all that thrilled about the idea of Mom driving us cross-country. She didn't have a valid driver's license, for one thing, and she'd always been a terrible driver. If Dad got too drunk, she ended up behind the wheel. But cars never seemed to run right for Mom. Once we were driving through downtown Phoenix and she couldn't get the brakes to work, and she had Brian and me stick our heads out the window and scream, "No brakes! No brakes!" as we rolled through intersections and she looked for something relatively soft to crash into. We ended up plowing into a dumpster behind a supermarket and walking home. Mom said that anyone critical of her driving could help with the task. Now that we had a car, she continued, we could leave the next morning. It was October, and we'd been in school for just over a month. But Mom said we had no time to tell our teachers we were withdrawing or to get any of our school records. When we enrolled in West Virginia, she'd vouched for our scholastic achievement. And once our new teachers heard us read, they'd realize we were all gifted. Dad was still refusing to come with us. When we left, he said, he was going to head out into the desert on his own to become a prospector. I asked Mom if we were going to sell the house on North 3rd Street or rent it out. Neither, she said. It's my house. She explained that it was nice to own something for a change, and she saw no point in selling it just because we were moving. She didn't want to rent it either, since she was opposed to anyone else living in her house. We'd leave it as it was. To prevent burglars and vandals from breaking in, we'd hang laundry on the clothesline and put dirty dishes in the sink. That way, Mom pointed out, potential intruders would think the house was occupied and would be fooled into believing that the people who live there might come home any second. The following morning, we packed up the car while Dad sat in the living room sulking. We tied Mom's art supplies to the roof and filled the trunk with pots and pans and blankets. Mom had bought each of us a warm coat at the thrift store so we'd have something to wear in West Virginia, where it got so cold in the winter that it snowed. Mom said we could take only one thing, like the time we left Battle Mountain. I wanted to bring my bike, but Mom said it was too big, so I brought my geode. I ran into the backyard and said goodbye to the orange trees, and then I ran out front to get in the Oldsmobile. I had to crawl over Brian and sit in the middle because he and Lori had already staked out the window seats. Maureen was in the front seat with Mom, who had started the engine and was practicing her gear shifts. Dad was still in the house, so I leaned over Brian and shouted at the top of my voice. Dad appeared in the doorway, his arms folded across his chest. "Dad, please come. We need you," I hollered. Lori and Brian and Mom and Maureen all chimed in. "We need you," we shouted. "You're the head of the family. You're the dad. Come on." Dad stood there looking at us for a minute. Then he flicked the cigarette he was smoking into the yard, closed the front door, loped over to the car, and told Mom to move aside. He was driving. Chapter 3. Welch. Back in Battle Mountain, we had stopped naming the Walls family cars because they were all such heaps that Dad said they didn't deserve names. Mom said when she was growing up on the ranch, they never named the cattle because they knew they would have to kill them. If we didn't name the car, we wouldn't feel as sad when we had to abandon it. So the piggy bank special was just the Oldsmobile, and we never said the name with any fondness or even pity. That Oldsmobile was a clunker from the moment we bought it. The first time it conked out, we were still an hour shy of the New Mexico border. Dad stuck his head under the hood, tinkered with the engine, and got it going. But it broke down a couple of hours later. Dad got it running, more like limping, he said. But it never went any faster than 15 or 20 miles an hour. And the hood kept popping up, so we had to tie it down with a rope.
We steered clear of toll booths by taking two-lane back roads, where we usually had a long line of drivers behind us, honking in exasperation. When one of the Oldsmobile's windows stopped rolling up in Oklahoma, we taped garbage bags over it. We slept in the car every night, and after arriving late in Muskogee and parking on an empty downtown street, we woke up to find a bunch of people surrounding the car, little kids pressing their noses against the windows and grown-ups shaking their heads and grinning. Mom waved at the crowd. "You know you're down and out when Okies laugh at you," she said. With our garbage bag-taped windows, our roped-down hood, and the art supplies tied to the roof, we'd out-Okied the Okies. The thought gave her a fit of the giggles. I pulled a blanket over my head and refused to come out until we were beyond the Muskogee city limits. "Life is a drama, full of tragedy and comedy," Mom told me. "You should learn to enjoy the comic episodes a little more." It took us a month to cross the country. We might as well have been traveling in a Conestoga wagon. Mom also kept insisting that we make scenic detours to broaden our horizons. We drove down to see the Alamo. "Davy Crockett and James Boy got what was coming to them," Mom said, "for stealing this land from the Mexicans." And over to Beaumont, where the oil rigs bobbed like giant birds. In Louisiana, Mom had us climb up on the roof of the car and pull down tufts of Spanish moss hanging from the tree branches. After crossing the Mississippi, we swung north toward Kentucky, then east. Instead of flat desert edged by craggy mountains, the land rolled and dipped like a sheet when you shook it clean. Finally, we entered hill country, climbing higher and deeper into the Appalachian Mountains, stopping from time to time to let the Oldsmobile catch its breath on the steep, twisting roads. It was November. The leaves had turned brown and were falling from the trees, and a cold mist shrouded the hillsides. There were streams and creeks everywhere, instead of the irrigation ditches you saw out west, and the air felt different. It was very still, heavier and thicker, and somehow darker. For some reason, it made us all grow quiet. At dusk, we approached a bend where hand-painted signs advertising auto repairs and coal deliveries had been nailed to trees along the roadside. We rounded the bend and found ourselves in a deep valley. Wooden houses and small brick buildings lined the river and rose in uneven stacks on both hillsides. "Welcome to Welch," Mom declared. We drove along dark, narrow streets, then stopped in front of a big, worn house. It was on the downhill side of the street, and we had to descend a set of stairs to get to it. As we clattered onto the porch, a woman opened the door. She was enormous, with pasty skin and about 3 chins. Bobby pins held back her lank gray hair, and a cigarette dangled from her mouth. "Welcome home, son," she said, and gave Dad a long hug. Then she turned to Mom. "Nice of you to let me see my grandchildren before I die," she said without a smile. Without taking the cigarette out of her mouth, she gave each of us a quick, stiff hug. Her cheek was tacky with sweat. "Pleased to meet you, Grandma," I said. "Don't call me Grandma," she snapped. "Name's Irma." "She don't like it none, 'cause it makes her sound old," said a man who appeared beside her. He looked fragile, with short white hair that stood straight up. His voice was so mumbly I could hardly understand him. I didn't know if it was his accent, or if maybe he wasn't wearing his dentures. "Name's Ted, but you can call me Grandpa," he went on. "Don't bother me none being a grandpa." Behind Grandpa was a ruddy-faced man with a wild swirl of red hair pushing out from under his baseball cap, which had a Maytag logo. He wore a red and black plaid coat, but had no shirt on underneath it. He kept announcing over and over again that he was our Uncle Stanley, and he wouldn't stop hugging and kissing me, as though I was someone he truly loved and hadn't seen in ages,
You could smell the whiskey on his breath. And when he talked, you could see the pink ridges of his toothless gums.
I stared at Irma and Stanley and Grandpa, searching for some feature that reminded me of Dad. But I saw none. Maybe this was one of Dad's pranks, I thought. Dad must have arranged for the weirdest people in town to pretend they were his family. In a few minutes, he'd start laughing and tell us where his real parents live. And we'd go there, and a smiling woman with perfumed hair would welcome us and feed us steaming bowls of cream of wheat. I looked at Dad. He wasn't smiling, and he kept pulling at the skin of his neck as if he were itchy. We followed Irma and Stanley and Grandpa inside. It was cold in the house, and the air smelled of mold and cigarettes and unwashed laundry. We huddled around a pot-bellied cast-iron coal stove in the middle of the living room and held out our hands to warm them. Irma pulled a bottle of whiskey from the pocket of her house dress, and Dad looked happy for the first time since we left Phoenix. Irma ushered us into the kitchen where she was fixing dinner. A bulb dangled from the ceiling, casting harsh light on the yellowed walls, which were coated with a thin film of grease. Irma stuck a curved steel handle into an iron disc on top of an old coal cooking stove, lifted it, and with her other hand, grabbed a poker from the wall and jabbed at the hot orange coals inside. She stirred a pot full of green beans stewing in fat back and poured in a big handful of salt. Then she set a tray of Pillsbury biscuits on the kitchen table and ladled out a plate of beans for each of us kids. The beans were so overcooked that they fell apart when I stuck my fork in them, and so salty I could barely force myself to swallow. I pinched my nose closed, which was the way Mom had taught us to get things down that had gone a little bit rotten. Irma saw me and slapped my hand away. "Beggars can't be choosers," she said. There were three bedrooms upstairs, Irma said. But no one had been to the second floor in nigh on 10 years because the floorboards were rotted through. Uncle Stanley volunteered to give us his room in the basement and sleep in a cot in the foyer while we were there. "We'll only be staying a few days," Dad said, "until we find a place of our own." After dinner, Mom and us kids went down into the basement. It was a big, dank room with cinder block walls and a green linoleum floor. There was another coal stove, a bed, a pull-out couch where Mom and Dad could sleep, and a chest of drawers painted fire engine red. It held hundreds of dog-eared comic books, Little Lulu, Richie Rich, Beetle Bailey, Archie and Jughead, that Uncle Stanley had collected over the years. Under the chest of drawers were jugs of genuine moonshine. We kids climbed into Stanley's bed. To make it less crowded, Lori and I lay with our heads on one end, and Brian and Maureen lay down with their heads at the other. Brian's feet were in my face, so I grabbed him by the ankles and started chewing on his toes. He laughed and kicked and started chewing on my toes in retaliation, and that made me laugh. We heard a loud thunk, thunk, thunk from above. "What's that?" Lori asked. "Maybe the roaches here are bigger than in Phoenix," Brian said. We all laughed and heard the thunk, thunk, thunk again. Mom went upstairs to investigate, then came down and explained that Irma was hitting the floor with a broom handle to signal that we were making too much noise. "She asked that you kids don't laugh while you're in her house," Mom said. "It gets on her nerves." "I don't think Irma likes us very much," I said. "She's just an old woman who's had a tough life," Mom said. "They're all sort of weird," Lori said. "We'll adapt," Mom said. "Or move on," I thought. The next day was Sunday. When we got up, Uncle Stanley was leaning against the refrigerator and staring intently at the radio. It made strange noises, not static, but a combination of shrieking and wailing. "That there's tongues," he said. "Only the Lord can understand it."
The preacher started talking in actual English, more or less. He spoke with a hillbilly accent so thick it was almost as hard to understand as the tongues. He asked all them good folk out there who'd been helped by this here channeling of the Lord's spirits to send contributions. Dad came into the kitchen and listened. "It's that sort of soul-curdling voodoo," he said, "that turned me into an atheist." Later that day, we got into the Oldsmobile, and Mom and Dad took us for a tour of the town. Welch was surrounded on all sides by such steep mountains that you felt like you were looking up from the bottom of a bowl. Dad said the hills around Welch were too steep for cultivating much of anything. Couldn't raise a decent head of sheep or cattle, couldn't even till crops except maybe to feed your family. So this part of the world was left pretty much alone until around the turn of the century, when robber barons from the north laid a track into the area and brought in cheap labor to dig out the huge fields of coal. We stopped under a railroad bridge and got out of the car to admire the river that ran through the town. It moved sluggishly, with barely a ripple. The river's name, Dad said, was the Tug. "Maybe in the summer we can go fishing and swimming," I said. Dad shook his head. The county had no sewer system, he explained. So when people flushed their johns, the discharge went straight into the Tug. Sometimes the river flooded and the water rose as high as the treetops. Dad pointed to the toilet paper up in the branches along the river's banks. The Tug, Dad said, had the highest level of fecal bacteria in any river in North America. "What's fecal?" I asked. Dad watched the river. "Shit," he said. Dad led us along the main road through town. It was narrow, with old brick buildings crowding in close on both sides. The stores, the signs, the sidewalks, the cars were all covered with a film of black coal dust, giving the town an almost monochromatic look, like an old hand-tinted photograph. Welch was shabby and worn out, but you could tell it had once been a place on its way up. On a hill stood a grand limestone courthouse with a big clock tower. Across from it was a handsome bank with arched windows and a wrought iron door. You could also tell that the people of Welch were still trying to maintain some pride of place. A sign near the town's only stoplight announced that Welch was the county seat of McDowell County, and that for years, more coal had been mined in McDowell County than any comparable spot in the world. Next to it, another sign boasted that Welch had the largest outdoor municipal parking lot in North America. But the cheerful advertisements painted on the sides of buildings like the Tick Tock Diner and the Pocahontas movie theater were faded and nearly illegible. Dad said bad times had come in the 50s. They hit hard and stayed. President John F. Kennedy had come to Welch not long after he was elected and personally handed out the nation's first food stamps here on McDowell Street to prove his point that, though ordinary Americans might find it hard to believe, starvation-level poverty existed right here in their own country. The road through Welch, Dad told us, led only farther into the wet, forbidding mountains and onto other dying coal towns. Few strangers passed through Welch these days, and almost all who did came to inflict one form of misery or another, to lay off workers, to shut down a mine, to foreclose on someone's house, to compete for the rare job opening. The townspeople didn't care much for outsiders. The streets were mostly silent and deserted that morning, but every now and then would pass a woman wearing curlers or a group of men in t-shirts with motor oil decals loitering in a doorway. I tried to catch their eyes, to give them a nod and a smile to let them know we had only good intentions. But they never nodded or spoke a word or even glanced our way. As soon as we passed, however, I could feel eyes following us up the street. Dad had brought Mom to Welch for a brief visit 15 years earlier, right after they were married. "Gosh, things have gone downhill a little bit since we were here last," she said. Dad gave a short snort of a laugh. He looked at her like he was about to say, "What the hell did I tell you?" Instead, he just shook his head. Suddenly, Mom grinned broadly.
I'll bet there aren't any other artists living in Welch, she said. I won't have any competition. My career could really take off here.
The next day, Mom took Brian and me to Welch Elementary, near the outskirts of town. She marched confidently into the principal's office with us in tow and informed him that he would have the pleasure of enrolling two of the brightest, most creative children in America in his school. The principal looked at Mom over his black-rimmed glasses but remained seated behind his desk. Mom explained that we'd left Phoenix in a teensy bit of a hurry, you know how that goes. And unfortunately, in all the commotion, she forgot to pack stuff like school records and birth certificates. But you can take my word for it that Jeanette and Brian are exceptionally bright, even gifted. She smiled at him. The principal looked at Brian and me, with our unwashed hair and our thin desert clothes. His face took on a sour, skeptical expression. He focused on me, pushed his glasses up his nose, and said something that sounded like, "What's it times them?" "Excuse me?" I said. "It times them," he said louder. I was completely bewildered. I looked at Mom. "She doesn't understand your accent," Mom told the principal. He frowned. Mom turned to me. "He's asking you, what's 8 times 7? "Oh," I shouted, 56. 8 times 7 is 56. I started spouting out all sorts of mathematical equations. The principal looked at me blankly. "He can't make out what you're saying," Mom told me. "Try to talk slowly." The principal asked me a few more questions I couldn't understand. With Mom translating, I gave answers that he couldn't understand. Then he asked Brian some questions, and they couldn't understand each other either. The principal decided that Brian and I were both a bit slow and had speech impediments that made it difficult for others to understand us. He placed us both in special classes for students with learning disabilities. "You'll have to impress them with your intelligence," Mom said as Brian and I headed off to school the next day. "Don't be afraid to be smarter than they are." It had rained the night before our first day of school. When Brian and I stepped off the bus at Welch Elementary, our shoes got soaked in the water that filled the muddy tire ruts left by the school buses. I looked around for the playground equipment, figuring I could win some new friends with the fierce tetherball skills I'd picked up at Emerson. But I didn't see a single seesaw or jungle gym, not to mention any tetherball poles. It had been cold ever since we arrived in Welch. The day before, Mom had unpacked the thrift shop coat she'd bought us in Phoenix. When I pointed out that all the buttons had been torn from mine, she said that minor flaw was more than offset by the fact that the coat was imported from France and made of 100% lamb's wool. As we waited for the opening bell, I stood with Brian at the edge of the playground, my arms crossed to keep my coat closed. The other kids stared at us, whispering among themselves. But they also kept their distance, as if they hadn't decided whether we were predators or prey. I had thought West Virginia was all white hillbillies, so I was surprised by how many black kids there were. I saw one tall black girl with a strong jaw and almond eyes smiling at me. I nodded and smiled back. Then I realized there was something malicious in her smile. I locked my arms tighter across my chest. I was in the 5th grade, so my day was divided into periods, with different teachers and classrooms for each. For the 1st period, I had West Virginia history. History was one of my favorite subjects. I was coiled and ready to raise my hand as soon as the teacher asked a question I could answer. But he stood at the front of the room next to a map of West Virginia, with all 55 counties outlined, and spent the entire class pointing to counties and asking students to identify them. In my 2nd period, we passed the hour watching a film of the football game that Welch High had played several days earlier. Neither of those teachers introduced me to the class. They seemed as uncertain as the kids about how to act around a stranger. My next class was English for students with learning disabilities. Miss Caparossi started out by informing the class that it might surprise them to learn that some people in this world